This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
What's that old saying? You can't manage it if you don't measure it? Okay, so what we know and what we intentionally don't know about gun violence in this country. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the 15th of February. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. As we sit here, 24 hours plus or minus since the shootings at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School down in Florida, questions are being asked still and again about how to stop this kind of insanity. Everybody's got their own version of an answer. What nobody really has, though, is substantive data, solid research about why mass shootings happen and what might work to stop them, because there is effectively a ban on spending federal money for research on gun violence. Marketplace's Amy Scott has been pitching this story for a while now. Today seemed like a real good day to do it.
In 1996, a Republican congressman named Jay Dickey wrote a provision in a federal spending bill backed by the NRA. It said that funding for the Centers for Disease Control could not be used to promote gun control.
It didn't say that you can't do research on gun violence prevention. What it basically said is you can't lobby for specific legislation for gun control.
That's Mark Rosenberg, who led the CDC's research on gun violence at the time. He says the Dickey Amendment had a chilling effect on federal funding.
It was a warning that if you do research in this area, we can make your life miserable.
The NRA did not respond to Marketplace's requests for comment today, but Stanford law professor John Donahue says the gun lobby doesn't want studies.
Most of the research, of course, would end up with conclusions that would be not helpful to gun manufacturers and sellers.
Like Donahue's own recent findings that laws allowing concealed carry are associated with increases in violent crime. While foundations and universities have stepped in with their own money, he says it's no substitute. Felice Levine, executive director of the American Educational Research Association, says without data,
we're limited in how we can prevent and ameliorate the impacts of violence.
The late Congressman Jay Dickey, by the way, regretted his amendment's effect on research. And former CDC official Mark Rosenberg says the team he led is still there and ready to look for answers. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Okay, more now about guns and money. Last year, the National Rifle Association, and this is according to the Center for Responsive Politics, last year the NRA spent about $5 million lobbying Congress. 10 years ago, the NRA lobbied to the tune of about $1.5 million a year, so that's a good-sized bump. But thinking of the NRA as just a Washington powerhouse lobbyist obscures its actual impact in this economy. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganzer has more now on the NRA's rise and reach.
The NRA was founded right after the Civil War by two veterans who were horrified at the terrible shooting skills of the typical Civil War soldier.
Most of them didn't really know one end of a gun from the other.
Robert Spitzer teaches gun policy at the State University of New York at Cortland. He says the NRA dipped a toe in politics in the 1930s, but it was mainly a group of hunters and sportsmen. Then came the Gun Control Act of 1968.
And that helped to propel a more dissident group within the NRA to eventually take over the organization in 1977.
But not everyone was happy about the NRA's transformation into political activism. And there's still some tension between the NRA's political arm and the hunters who used to be in control. Kristen Goss teaches public policy at Duke University. She says in surveys, NRA members will support things like background checks for private gun sales.
You know, you will find majorities of NRA members in those surveys supporting that policy, but that is not a policy that the NRA as an organization supports.
But Goss says those members stay in the NRA, sometimes for practical reasons. These days, you can get discounts on insurance and hotels with an NRA membership.
They've got sort of corporate partners who, you know, like to have access to these, you know, several million members.
The NRA offers firearms training. It holds fundraising dinners across the country. It's a far cry from the 1980s, when Richard Feldman worked as an NRA lobbyist.
We went through an awful lot of cycles when I was at NRA in the 80s where we'd be out of money.
Feldman estimates that today, the NRA's budget is upwards of $300 million a year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, everything is hunky-dory, thanks. The major indices up 1% or more. But I will just add here for a little bit of context. A week ago today, the Dow closed off more than 1,000 points. Seems like forever ago, huh? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I think it's better than even money that I have said the word inflation on this program more than any other word the past week or 10 days or so. There were fears of wage-induced inflation after the most recent unemployment report. We told you about that. There was consumer inflation yesterday. And then this morning, the report on January wholesale inflation, the producer price index, as it's called, also up a bit. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on the inflation beat today.
Producer price inflation was barely evident in the years after the Great Recession. Not anymore, says fund manager Jerry Paul at Icon Advisors.
We're certainly seeing inflation signs that we haven't seen in the last 9 years.
So what's going on? Here's William Klein at the Peterson Institute.
Textbook economics would say that if you're at full employment and you keep increasing the fiscal deficit, you're eventually going to get inflation.
Producers are domestic suppliers of raw materials and manufacturing components, plus services like accounting and insurance. They have to hike pay to attract workers and compete for capital with government borrowing, so voila, producer prices go up. Plus, the strong global economy has pushed the U.S. dollar lower, making it more expensive to buy stuff from overseas, says Andrew Hunter at Capital Economics.
That's already feeding through into much stronger import price inflation, and I think it's only a matter of time before that starts to feed through into the consumer price numbers as well.
So, how worried should we be? Here again are William Klein and Jerry Paul.
I think there's still going to be a lot of caution before people will declare that inflation is a serious risk.
It's got most of us bond people guarded. I'd like to see more data points yet.
The Federal Reserve is also watching closely for signs of rising inflation as it decides how much to raise interest rates this year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Speaking of the Federal Reserve, I talked inflation on the program yesterday, by the way, with Robert Kaplan, the president of the Dallas Fed. We've got it on our website, marketplace.org. There's lots of good stuff in there besides just inflation. There's that word again. A quick update on congressional action on immigration reform now. It's not happening. All of the bills up for consideration in the Senate failed today. What happens now? Couldn't tell you. Hey, you remember the European debt crisis? Yeah, that is so 3 years ago. The latest figures from the European Commission in Brussels show the European Union grew at a rate of 2.5% last year. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one from London.
The one thing you don't expect from European economists, practitioners of the so-called dismal science, is optimism. But listen to this.
We've got good investment, good household consumption, and of course, good net trade.
Simon Wells, chief European economist at HSBC Bank. And here's Nick Kennedy of consulting firm Independent Strategy, also enthusing about the state of the Eurozone economy.
You could argue it's best health it's been in since the single currency was created.
18 years ago, the Eurozone has boomed thanks to very cheap money. The euro's key interest rate is less than the rate of inflation. And, says Jennifer Macchione of Capital Economics, the global backdrop is benign.
Global demand has been relatively healthy, and the countries of Europe have been benefiting from that, most notably Germany, which is a heavy exporter.
But the recovery is broad-based. France, Spain, and even to some extent Italy have also enjoyed an upturn. Macchione believes the action to cut government indebtedness has helped.
Government deficits have been eradicated, in many cases turned to surpluses, so the public finances are far less shaky, and household debts have come down a bit too.
But this is economics, so inevitably there is a cloud around the silver-lined recovery. Simon Wells.
Yes, it's broad-based. Yes, it's very good. But we might be at or certainly approaching the peak.
It's a cyclical recovery, he says, and this could be the best it gets. But the Eurozone can at least enjoy its moment in the sun and revel in the discomfiture of the Brexiteers in Britain. They'd argued they wanted to leave the EU because they didn't want to be shackled to a corpse. The corpse is very much alive and in the last quarter grew at double the rate that Britain did. At the European Desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Where you live, where you're able to live really, affects a whole lot of things in your life. Your job, your health, how economically well off you are. I framed it that way, where you're able to live, because 50 years after what's known as redlining was outlawed, that is the deliberate and systemic exclusion from the mortgage finance process of African Americans and minorities, 50 years after it was outlawed, it is still going on systemically. That's the result of a new investigation by Reveal and the Center for Investigative Reporting. Aaron Glantz shared the byline on that story. Aaron, thanks for coming on.
Good to be with you.
There was an amazing story in this piece. A woman of color goes to apply for a mortgage to buy a house. She's working at a university in a good job. She can't get the loan until her partner, who's working like at a grocery store for $145 every 3 weeks or something, co-signs the loan. And of course, the partner is half white, half Japanese.
Yeah. One of the people we interviewed for this story, Rochelle Faroul, she spent 2 years trying to get a mortgage. First, she was teaching computer coding at a university. She was turned down because she was a contractor. So she went and got a job managing a $1 million grant at an Ivy League college and went back, tried to get a mortgage again, got turned down again. Eventually, she said, well, what if I bring on my partner? And her partner was half white, half Japanese, and her most recent paycheck was for $144. Hmm. And the lender said, okay, now we can go for it. Now this is good to go. Now you can buy the house.
There's an urban decay part of this story as well, and that is that redlining, when it went into effect in the 30s, excluded a lot of those areas from development, and that the relic of that development, right, the lack of investment continues to this day, and you can see it when you go around to cities in this country.
So back in the 1930s, the government literally drew lines on maps, identified the neighborhoods with large numbers of African Americans or immigrants, colored them in red, and said they were hazardous and that banks should not lend there. Even after discrimination was banned, banks were still not lending in these communities. So in 1977, Congress came back again, and Jimmy Carter signed the Community Reinvestment Act. And it said banks have an affirmative obligation. They have to try to lend in these communities. What we found in our investigation is, despite this pervasive disparity across the country, that 99% of banks are getting a satisfactory or outstanding rating from the federal banking regulators who enforce this law.
Well, what do they say? What do the regulators say and what do the banks say when you go to them and say, what?
The regulators say that no bank is forced to make any particular loan and you have to look at the underwriting. And, of course, we don't have the access to the underwriting on every particular loan, but it doesn't make any sense. You know, are you telling me that on a systemic basis, black people and white people who make the same amount of money that the white people on a systemic basis are more creditworthy? Maybe there's something wrong here. But there's another aspect to it, which is that this law, the Community Reinvestment Act, did not foresee a lot of the urban dynamics that we have today. I mean, they were worried about urban blight. And the whole phenomenon of gentrification that we're seeing now, it just didn't exist. And one of the things that we found in our reporting is that there are a lot of neighborhoods where banks are making a ton of loans to white newcomers at the same time that they're denying a large proportion of people of color who want to buy or refinance or get a home improvement loan to stay in that same neighborhood.
One of the things we haven't talked about is the sort of more big picture socioeconomic thing, which is one of the ways you build individual wealth in this economy is by home ownership. And part of the reason that there's such a gap in black-white wealth in this country is because blacks have been excluded from buying homes, in part because of redlining like this.
Right. So today, according to the Census Bureau, the average white family is worth about 15 times the average black one. 15 times. And a lot of that has to do with the homeownership gap that we talked about earlier, that the homeownership gap in America today is wider than it was when segregation was legal and discrimination was legal. Our investigation found that in 61 cities across America, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Detroit, Chico, California, that in all of these places, even when you control for income and the size of the loan and the neighborhood that somebody wants to buy in, that people of color are more likely to be turned away. And then we turn and we say, well, we have this huge racial wealth gap. Are these two things connected? You tell me.
Aaron Glantz is a reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. The most recent piece about redlining still in this economy is called Kept Out. Aaron, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up.
They've allowed people to stop using substances, and they've allowed them to reintegrate into society and work in productive ways.
Injecting drugs safely. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 1.2% today, 306 points, closed at 25,200. Hello, old friend. The NASDAQ gained 1.5%, 1.5%, I suppose, is another way to say that. 112 points, 72.56. The S&P 500 up 1.2%, 32 points, ended at 27.31. Air travel is booming, so too are companies that make airplanes. Shares of Airbus soared 10.2% today. Boeing accelerated 3.33%. Raytheon, maker of a whole lot of what goes inside the cockpits on those planes, built 2.6% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.9%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal with today's entry in the Business is Complicated file. Google, as you might know, gets something like 90% of its revenue from showing you ads. I'm telling you that because the company is launching a new ad blocking feature for its Chrome web browser today. It'll automatically hide ads on websites that use certain annoying and intrusive kinds of advertising, pop-ups for just one example. Turns out, annoying people is no way to run a business, as Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
Google says it's blocking the ads its users complain about the most, like videos that autoplay at full volume, flashing ads, and giant pop-ups you can't figure out how to close. Brendan McCormick is a spokesman for the Coalition for Better Ads, which defined the standards. The group was formed by Google and later joined by other advertisers, publishers, and trade associations.
Consumers were becoming increasingly frustrated with ads that disrupted their searches for content, and that was showing up in increased adoption of ad blockers that were consumers' way of pushing back against these bad ad experiences.
So far, 18% of American desktop users have ad-blocking software, which vastly reduces the number of ads they see, and in turn reduces the revenue for publishers and for Google. And those annoying ads, they tend to pay publishers more because they don't easily go away. Melissa Simpson is with mobile ad firm Cargo, which used to specialize in some of these sticky, eye-popping ads on Google's no-fly list. She says her company began phasing them out last year.
Now, in 2018, we've completely sunset them and no longer are supporting them. And we're happy with the new guidelines that are coming out because it's helping the demand side stop basically asking for them.
Ad blocking software still hasn't really caught on for mobile, and Simpson wants to keep it that way.
I think everyone realizes that there needs to be these standards in place. It's kind of not the Wild West anymore, if you will.
Look, we all want a better user experience and a better internet.
Ophir Tans is CEO of GumGum, a company that uses artificial intelligence to create display ads within images. He thinks standards are good, but is worried Google will have the power to stifle innovation.
Who's to say that next month a product representing millions of dollars of investment won't be banned the day after its release? And what about the month after that?
Tan says he and other ad tech firms hope Google sets up a transparent appeals process for its ad blocking standards. Google already controls more than 40% of the digital ad market and about half of all web traffic via search. And more than half of internet users browse on Chrome. Terry Taus is a consultant with AdProfs, which works with publishers and ad tech companies.
If your lifeblood as a publisher is based on your ability to generate advertising, and Google can unilaterally just decide, hey, this ad doesn't look good, we're turning your advertising off, that's like a big, big problem.
The average publisher in the U.S. has seen revenue drop 15% because of ad blockers, according to PageFair, a company that helps publishers recapture that lost revenue by circumventing them. CEO Sean Blanchfield says clients know bad ads are a problem, but are uncomfortable giving Google more control of their industry.
Publishers are increasingly feeling like they are really in a gig economy, no longer independent businesses, but more like Uber drivers. They're monetizing Google users with Google ads coming to them in a Google web browser.
Google says it's given the industry plenty of heads up, and it provides a tool that lets publishers check their sites for offending ads. The company says of the 100,000 websites it's evaluated, just 1% failed to meet the new standards. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrenk for Marketplace.
More cities across the country are opening up what are called supervised injection sites, places that addicts can go to inject themselves with some degree of safety. In Philadelphia, the city is inviting private organizations to open and run those sites with staff who would hand out clean needles or connect drug users with treatment as appropriate. It's not uncontroversial, but proponents are making the argument that safe injection makes economic sense. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Your number, sir?
26502.
Philadelphia's heroin problem is on full display at Prevention Point, which runs a needle exchange in an old brick church along the L tracks. This is Kensington, a neighborhood where abandoned buildings give way to encampments. People in tents, others on mattresses under bridges. Just this afternoon, 300 people come through. Some look healthy and well-dressed, others disheveled. Lesions on their faces.
Are you going to be all right for the weekend? Because we're closed on Monday.
Yes.
People here swap old needles for new. One of them is 37-year-old heroin user Anne. We're not using her last name because she's concerned about being targeted for her drug use. Anne says she's been revived after ODing 5 times.
I've turned blue. I stopped breathing. People couldn't wake me up.
Giving people like Anne a better chance of surviving overdoses is a main argument for supervised injection. Prevention Point's Jose Benitez says a needle exchange isn't enough.
1,200 people died in the last calendar year. We're talking about saving people's lives.
The city believes the sites will save up to 75 people every year. In a recent report, it's also touting the economic benefits of supervised heroin use. It's an expensive problem to manage right now. Every day, city workers fan out across Philadelphia.
Our ambulance drivers, our doctors, our case managers, the list goes on and on.
Eva Gladstein, Deputy Director for Health and Human Services, estimates the opioid crisis costs Philadelphia well over $26 million a year. But city officials also know it can be difficult to drum up much sympathy for people who wrestle with heroin addiction. So City Hall talks about how these sites would drive down spending on the epidemic, and that could benefit everybody.
Instead of being able to use that money to beautify a park or to fill a pothole, we're spending that on shelter or tearing down a vacant or abandoned building.
The city says safe injection sites would reduce expensive ambulance rides, emergency room trips, and hospital visits, saving at least $2 million every year in direct health care costs. Temple University health economist Catherine McLean says there's a lot of evidence that treatment, which will be offered through safe injection sites, carries its own economic benefits.
They've allowed people to stop using substances, and they've allowed them to reintegrate into society and work in productive ways.
But treatment costs money and takes time. Plenty of people relapse. Plus, Philadelphia intends to provide housing services through the safe injection sites. Some could need those services for years, which could wipe out savings, says Northwestern's Craig Garthwaite. But the economist says maybe, in this case, money isn't the point.
Even if we don't save money,
but we have fewer people dying, I would think that maybe we want to think that's a good thing, right? That it doesn't need to show up just in cost savings. It can show up in increased longevity and fewer people passing away.
The city hopes to open the first safe injection site in the next 6 to 12 months. The challenge in Philadelphia and other U.S. cities is persuading critics that saving lives in and of itself is reason enough. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I think McDonald's doesn't quite get it. The company announced today it's revamping the nutrition standards for its Happy Meals. Less sugar in the chocolate milk, less salt overall, and fewer calories. Yay, all good things. But the company is taking cheeseburgers out of the Happy Meal lineup, making them really more sad meals than happy. Am I right? Also, Chicken McNuggets get to stay? How does that work? All right, we are out of here. Dow Industrials up about 300 in 6 points, 1 2/10%. The NASDAQ gained 1.5%, 112 points. S&P 500 up 1.2%, 32 points. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.